took a well-earned break from punching my face.
There. He's not going nowhere. Here we are. You know that stuff His Holiness was saying about how he'd pop out your eyeballs and piss in the holes?
I remember.
He will, you know. I've seen him do it to people.
Thanks. I was left alone in the cell. Naked to the waist and shoeless. Big manacles around my arms led to a heavy metal plate on the wall. It was dark and wet and horrid. And I fell asleep.
Clorican, my brother.
As I drifted away, it was as if I was still in the cell, but before me was my sister Nuala. Small, elfin, a little ragamuffin. Around her neck was a little crystal pendant. She looked delighted to see me.
Oh, I was so hoping that she'd come to see me. It's been so lonely here. I have so many things to tell you.
Nuala, how did you get here? The door is closed with cold iron. I don't understand.
But I didn't come to see you. You came to see me. You're in the dreaming, my brother.
And then I realized I was now dressed in finery. My manacles and my bruises gone.
Clorican, are you all right?
No, I'm not. I think I've rather messed everything up.
Clorican, are you in trouble again?
That is indeed one way of putting it.
Bad trouble?
I'm afraid so.
Oh dear. Isn't there something I can do?
Can you break bonds of cold iron? Or open cold iron doors?
Don't you worry your heart about me, sister. I'll be fine on my own. I always am. Everything will work out for the best. Just don't worry.
Nobody is fine on their own, Clorican. People need people. I'll get help.
No.
And then I woke to my sad reality. A damp cell, a stone wall, a metal plate set into it, chains hanging down to my arms, and me, bruised and hurt, with the bruises spreading and looking worse.
Ugh, no. Stupid dream.
Oak and ash and thorn, I thought. But the Queen would be angry when she heard I was dead, and I can't say I was thrilled about it either.
A good day to you, Clorican of Ferry.
Lord of Dreams. Morpheus emerged from the shadows, wrapped in his big black cloak, fire flickering at its hem. His eyes, the stars in those black pits in that clay-white face, held me.
What brings you here?
Your sister, Nuala, has spent some time imploring me to come to your assistance. I have, albeit reluctantly, agreed so to do.
Reluctantly, Lord Shaper? I would hate to put you out in any way.
Clorican, it is one to me whether you live or die. It is not one to your sister, and she serves me well and faithfully. I would not see her needlessly distressed.
But you do not care that I might be needlessly distressed? Or that my queen might be inconvenienced?
Titania has other ambassadors, and what happens to you is of little consequence to me. Well, shall I free you?
If you please, Lord Shaper.
Very well.
He held out his hand, and some glittering things like little stars fell toward my arms.
I am grateful.
As you should be. Do you wish to leave this plane at this time?
Would that I could, but my queen would not take my return kindly, my task still undone. My Lord Shaper, the cell door is also of cold iron.
So it is. Aprite.
Ah, very good.
We walked together down a narrow stone corridor in the castle. There were other people walking down the corridor. No one noticed us.
Very well. I have done as your sister asked of me. I will take my leave of you, Clorican. Have you a message for her?
Tell her that I will visit her yet in your castle, and tell her the Clurican owes her his life. And if we of the fair folk had souls, he would owe her that too.
I will tell her. Your sister, she has a good heart, Clurican. Farewell.
He left me then, and I found myself alone in the palace of the Universal Aurelian Church that had once been the tomb of Caris Carnifex, now the home of Nephew Mehran, who, united within himself the roles of spiritual leader and temporal lord in defiance of certain laws, Nephew Mehran, who seemed to be coming close to uniting the cities of the plains. Well, I had been instructed to prevent such an alliance from coming about. I resolved to do it as best I could, with all the resources and craft and glamour I possessed, not to mention a certain amount of malice. Thus it was that before the sun set, an elderly priest, perhaps a little the worse for drink, was heard to swear blind that he had seen the psychopomp sodomizing a virgin child in front of a statue of the Holy Twins.
This I swear!
Also, that the psychopomp had claimed that administering the Blessed Sacrament meant as little to him as wiping his anus. And, indeed, he had performed both actions at the same time. Shortly after that, a young noble, again in his cups, bragged, perhaps too loudly, to an assemblage of whores of the city that he was hired by the psychopomp to murder the Carnifex's heir in a staged street brawl. And that's not the off of it. A foreign soldier confided in an innkeeper that the Carnifex was entering into an agreement with the folks of the plains to sell the free citizens of Aurelia into slavery, to cover the debts of the church treasury. The innkeeper took no time in repeating these tidings to his customers. And, most damning of all, a man whom his own mother would have sworn to be the Archvicar of Western Aurelia went down on his knees in a public street and confessed loudly, in the name of the twins, that the treaty proclaiming Carnifex and Psychopomp one and the same was a crass forgery. It's amazing how much one can accomplish in an evening if one is willing to expend a little effort and to walk briskly. A huge moon hung in the sky that night as the psychopomp walked through the palace through an open passageway overlooking the city. With him was Brother Cabriolet. The city itself was lit by burning flares and riven by discontent.
What's happening? In the name of all that's holy, tell me what is happening!
Your Grace, it would appear that the city is in revolt.
I know that, Cabriolet! I'm not stupid! But why? How?
They say that your predecessor, Caris the 34th, appeared to the multitude and announced that you had him poisoned.
Lies!
And that the treaty was a forgery, and
enough! That... This citadel has withstood worse over the centuries. Yeah, well, where are the palace guard?
Your Grace... The palace guard have been sent for, but there appears to be...
Oh, why now, when the palace is filled with ambassadors and envoys? They'll think I've lost control. I am still in control. Damn it, I am!
Of course you are, Your Grace.
I'll damn their eyes to all the hells! Very well. This foolishness will blow over by morning. In the meantime, we will remove ourselves to a place of safety. Down here, bring that torch.
Yes, Your Grace.
This is now the holy palace of the psychopomp, but it is also the tomb of every Carnifex since the first Caris, the 8th Emperor. Each Carnifex has been embalmed and interred, enthroned and crowned in this place, and only I have the key. Key. Where's the... The room under this slab is impregnable. We can wait out the storm in here.
Sealing the chamber up behind them, the psychopomp and Brother Cabriolet, carrying the torch, descended into a stone chamber.
There we go. We'll be safe the night in here.
At the far end, a round, stained glass window took up one wall. Along the other walls were rows of huge stone chairs, and in each stone chair sat, or lolled, a corpse, dressed in rich imperial robes with a circlet on its forehead. The corpses were in various states of decay, the nearer ones in better shape than those further away. The psychopomp walked over to one of the seated corpses. It was that of an old man, embalmed, still fleshy but dead 5 years and rotten, in rich but corpse-stained robes, its head lolled on one side.
Recognize him? My predecessor as Carnifex. Ugly old bugger, wasn't he?
The psychopomp reached out, grabbed the dead emperor under the chin, lifting the lolling head to look at him.
You're looking remarkably well preserved, Carys. You know I didn't poison you, don't you? You know it's all lies. Why would anyone poison a man with a terminal cancer? Waste a good poison.
They walked to the stained glass window. It overlooked the city below, and the psychopomp pushed his face against it to look out over his fiefdom.
Aren't you scared, Your Grace?
Scared? Not likely. I know the folk of Aurelia. A foolish, confused rabble. They don't have the will to rebel. When the sun rises, they will creep back to their homes and hovels, abashed and ashamed. I will wait here while they riot. And then I will walk through the city with the palace guard beside me. And in my role as Carnifex of Aurelia, I will pronounce sentence of death on every tenth man, while as the conductor of their souls, as the church's leader, I will damn all their souls to eternal cold and dark. And I will find out who is responsible for this insurrection. And I will...
pop out their eyeballs with your thumbs and piss into the open sockets.
Yes.
Your Grace, I know who caused this evening's shenanigans.
The psychopomp turned to look at Brother Cabriolet, his eyes wide.
Who? I want to know his name.
Lord Clorican of Ferry.
Me. Didn't anyone ever tell you it's bad luck to cross the Fairfolk?
I'll kill you.
I spoke the truth to you yestermorn, Nephew Mehran. Your time is done.
The psychopomp moved towards me. He was very fat, but he was fast, with both hands reaching out as if to tear out my eyes.
Why, you...
He was stopped, and his throat was gripped by the claw-like hand of a corpse arm of leathery skin over bones and tendons. The corpse head turned to look him in the eye.
You have brought shame on the city.
Is this more of your trickery, fairy?
No, not one of mine.
The corpse rose from its throne, lurching towards the psychopomp.
You stole my throne!
Keep away from me!
And that's when he stumbled backwards. The dead Carnifex at his throat.
No!
They fell. But now the dead begin to rise. And debts forgotten, time collects. Well, well, well. It was time to go.
Stop him, guards! You've come to Aurelia once too often.
When this is over, my friend, there'll be no need for me to come again.
Ha-ha!
On the way down the stairs, I had a really invigorating sword fight with the palace guard. I made my way to the stables, where I harnessed up my mount.
Come on!
I rode off down the hill, fairly confident that any possibility of an alliance of the cities of the plains was more or less utterly scuppered. At the bottom of the hill,
whoa,
I observed where nephew Mehran had fallen. The dogs of the town had already gnawed off much of his face, and soon the rats would be clambering through his ribcage. Of the dead Carnifex, there was no sign. And I was on my way home when this damnable storm blew up and the way between the worlds became impassable. So I made my way here, to the world's end, to wait it out and to get more than a little drunk in the undertime. And that is my story. Ah, thank you, landlady. My throat is a little dry.
Was that the truth, Clorican?
All of it. Except the sword fight with the palace guard, which I threw in to add excitement and local colour to an otherwise bald and insipid narrative. I suppose there might have been a few other details and incidents I added or omitted, as seemed necessary to ensure the tale flowed properly.
Well, I don't believe a word of it.
How did the dead... what was he called? The Carnifex? Come back to life?
How should I know? I lived it. I didn't make it up.
And this queen of yours, was she happy with the outcome?
Her moods are not mine to know, sir. You and your friends are new arrivals?
I am Claw the Unconquered.
And I am Stalker the Soulless.
And are you going to see your sister now?
Enough! I will not be questioned further. I have entertained you, whiled away an idle hour. If more stories are to be told, then others will have to tell them. And I am prepared both to drink and to listen. So, whose tale is next? Yours, young fellow, me lad. Go on.
Call me Jim.
Hello, Jim.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Jim.
I don't know how long Charlene and I had been sheltering from the storm at the inn by this point. But the drink was flowing, and the food was good, and we'd pushed the tables together so that everybody in this weird group of misfits, from stranded Americans to ghoulish necropolitans and pointy-eared fairies, could join in the storytelling.
Excuse me, can I have a sip of water first?
Of course, Jim. Kyron, a fresh jug, please.
Here, my dear.
Thank you.
Jim was a boy, about 16, I'd say. Curly red hair, no beard growing yet. He was dressed kind of like a sailor from a few years back. A loose tie, an open shirt, and an English waistcoat.
I'll tell you all a story. It's a true story, too, though you mayn't believe it. And there are times I don't believe it. Though I was there, and I saw what I saw.
Here.
Thank you. Before I tell it, though, I've a question I was wondering if someone here could answer for me. Where are we?
You're at World's End. The inn at the end of the worlds.
But what country is this? What place?
World's End is its own place, Jim.
Oh. You see, there was a storm come up out of nowhere at midnight. We were swept onto the rocks, where there shouldn't be rocks, neither know how. A few of us made it into the ship's boat, and we pulled ashore, but onto what shore none of us could tell. And the storm was still blowing once we got ashore, but we saw the lights of the inn, and in we came.
There's a coastline near here?
Brant, shh. Harry there, he said this place was Fiddler's Green.
Aye. Where the good sailors come when they die at sea.
But that's all nonsense. Like the stories of the great ship or of Mother Carey. Silly stuff.
I'll believe what I choose, lad.
I, for my sins, keep thinking of an opium den I was taken to in Singapore when I was younger, and thinking that perhaps I am still there now, and that everything that has happened to me since then was some strange kind of opium dream.
I'm nobody's bleeding dream.
So, where are we? And what kind of storm is this? And who are all of you?
We're travelers, like you.
And we're stranded by the storm, like you.
Yeah. I hit this weird snowstorm in June, would you believe?
June? But it's September.
June, 1993.
It's September 1914.
Enough of this gabbling. I'm for the story.
Very well. Here's my yarn, and while I've been waiting to tell it for 2 years, it's true as ever I'm sitting here.
The Sandman, Act 3, Episode 16. End. Hobbes Leviathan.
I was born in 1899 in Sydney, Australia, the only child of a sea captain and of an English widow woman who ran a small boarding house. She did not talk of my father, and I suppose that it is to her credit that I was neither adopted out nor aborted, but that she braved all the scandal and social discomfort caused by the arrival of her child. From my mother, I inherited, I fancy, a certain willfulness. From my father, I inherited a wanderlust and a fascination with the sea. So it was that on the day of my 13th birthday, I clambered out of my bedroom window and, dressed in old clothes I'd begged and borrowed from friends, ran down to the docks, where, claiming myself an orphan, I signed aboard the Spirit of Whitby, a vessel en route to Singapore.
20 fathom, sail and
sand! Steady, helmsman!
I didn't smoke and I didn't drink, which meant that by the time we reached Singapore, I had earned myself a little money. Too many sailors finished their journey in debt to the captain, you see. The next ship I signed on, the Pyramus, was a dark ship.
When I say look lively, you look lively!
Captained by a bad man. And with regret, I jumped ship one night in Bombay. There was a mutiny shortly thereafter, or so I heard, and the ship went down with all hands. I signed aboard the Sea Witch, carrying tea and cotton from Bombay to Liverpool. She was a beautiful ship, a barkentine.
Jim, take the watch while those drunkards are ashore carousing.
The captain was Herbert Burgrave. He was an old man. Must have been in his 50s. We'd been forced to wait an extra week in Bombay, for what reason I knew not, and he was in a poor temper.
I'll be below in my cabin, trying to make the penny stretch to pounds with this miserable cargo.
Hello there! Ahoy! Permission to come aboard!
Gangplank's over there, mister.
Can I speak to your captain, lad?
Aye, sir. This way. Finally, one night, a gentleman came on board and asked to see the captain. He was an Englishman, his beard trim and neat, his eyes and voice friendly, and I showed him to the captain's cabin. Waiting outside, I heard voices raised. After some time, the captain called me in. Yes, Captain?
This is Mr. Gatling. He'll be our passenger on the voyage. Going back to England, he is. Mr. Gatling, this is Jim. He's a hard-working lad, and he'll be your steward for the voyage when he's not needed elsewhere.
Very good to meet you, Jim.
I liked this man.
And Mr. Gatling, I am not one for passengers. Mouths to feed who don't pull their weight. This is a Sea Witch, not the Savoy Hotel, if you get my drift.
I do indeed.
Jim, show Mr. Gatling to his cabin. We'll be setting sail at dawn.
This way, Mr. Gatling, sir. This here's your cabin.
And that door at the end there?
The wardroom. You'll mess in there with the bosun and his mates.
Ah, we'll see.
The captain didn't much care for passengers, but Mr. Gatling was paying his way, and I got the impression that it didn't matter if the captain liked it or not. He could do nothing about it.
2-6-3!
The sky was dawn grey, and a chill wind came up off the waves as we hauled on the sheets, the ropes that hoisted the sails aloft.
Cast off, bosun!
Aye, cabin!
Think on it, and you'll be there. The creaking of the rigging, then the magical moment as the sails majestically lifted and straightened and filled. I stood there sweating with the rope in my hands, and the sun broke above the horizon, and the gulls mewed, and the grey sea turned to sapphire. And I knew this would be a good voyage. In half a day, we were out of sight of land. It's a strange life, aboard a tall ship. The Sea Witch was his own little world. The sailors were from every land under the sun, or so it seemed. There was a German from Hamburg, a taciturn cove, who would, when rummed up, tell us how the Kaiser would soon put us all in our places. There was a tall Norwegian and an equally tall Swede who hated each other's guts. They'd shipped together before, and there was an old quarrel there, although I never knew the bones of it. Among the sailors were Africans, West Indians, and Americans. One of them, Nathaniel Dawning by name, we called him Dawny, was the best sailor on the ship. He was the second mate, and the general opinion on the Sea Witch was that he would have been a captain, if only he were white. There was an Irish cook, and a good one, a rarity on board, who read poetry of a night in his hammock. And a Scottish engineer, who minded the engine that pumped out the bilges. His name was Campbell, but the skipper used to call him Donkey Man because of the days when a donkey would walk a treadmill in the hold, fulfilling the functions his engines did now. The first mate was a Californian named Camby. He took a shine to me, did Mr. Camby. While I fed the chickens on the main deck, he used to tell me,
"I don't know what you're doing here, lad. Ships like this aren't going anywhere. 10 years' time, the only tall ships will be in museums."
"It's too big to fit in a museum."
"Yeah, funny. Steamships, that's the future. Who wants to be forced to ride the wind?"
"I do. I've been on a steamship, and I didn't like it one little bit. They're rust buckets, Mr. Canby, the lot of them. All that smoke. And what's the point of being a sailor if you're living high above the ocean instead of cool and comfortable below decks, cooled by the water, listening to the sea going by?"
"You're a romantic.
Why be a sailor if you're not?" This was on the fifth day out from Bombay.
"Mr. Canby!"
"Yes, Donnie?"
"Over here. Shake a leg."
"Right. You better come with me, boy."
"There's been food disappearing, you see, Jim. So, me and Mr. Canby."
"Quiet!"
The hold was stacked high with bales of cotton and crates of tea.
"Back here! Got him!"
Mr. Canby stood up, holding a small Indian gentleman in rumpled clothing by the scruff of his neck.
"Right then, you! What do you mean by it, eh?"
I am sorry, sir. However, I would appreciate it were you not to hurt me."
"I'm not going to hurt you. I'm taking you up to see the captain. Now, he may hurt you."
"Oh, dear."
"Come on, you."
"I can assure you, I am not dawdling."
"Morning, Mr. Gadling."
"Good morning, Jim. Have we a guest?"
"Taking him to the captain."
"I'll join you."
The Indian gentleman was a strange little duck. He was well-dressed, very small, and very delicate of face and feature, with a pince-nez pair of spectacles, behind which he had the most peculiar almond-coloured eyes.
"A stowaway. You know, Gunga Din, I don't take particularly kindly to stowaways on my ship."
"Esteemed sir, while I must perforce apologise profusely for concealing myself on your ship, I would not have done so had I not been placed in a grossly untenable position. You see, I quite need to get to Liverpool."
"Well, you won't be doing it on the Sea Witch, damn your eyes. You're going to be put in chains in the lazarette, where, because I'm not a cruel man, you'll be fed ship's biscuit and given water to drink."
"Captain."
"And then I'll have you put off at Aden. And you can count yourself lucky that I don't have you thrown overboard."
"Captain Burgrave, might I have a word with you?"
"Oh, Oh, it's you. Hold your blasted tongue, Gatling.
I'm afraid we must talk about this, Captain. Now.
Very well. All of you, get out. Dawning, keep tight hold of the little rat's arse.
It is indeed a pleasant day, gentlemen. The magnificent sapphire sea, the balmy breeze. Does it not make you feel most good to be alive?
Shut up, you.
But this is a day of miracles. After all, I have spent days in the stinky hold, coming out only at night. Is it not wonderful, boy?
Don't talk to him, Jim.
Jim? An excellent name. Short, if I am not mistaken, for James.
There. That's all taken care of. You can let him go now, gentlemen.
Captain?
Let go of him, you swabs. This is our newest passenger. Mr. Gadling's taking care of his passage to Liverpool.
Oh.
Jim, show the gentleman to the purser's cabin and tell Mr. Stewart he's bunking with the men. And tell his nibs how lucky he is on the way.
He's not lying. You are lucky. Last ship I was on, they found a stowaway. The skipper hit him aside the head with an iron belaying pin, and over the side he went.
Then it is a good thing that I chose to travel on the Sea Witch.
The next few weeks were, well, perfect, I suppose. The trade winds blew steadily. We made better speed than we had any right to, and even bought ourselves some loafing time. The sun shone, and the chickens kept laying, and the cook gave me a book called Saltwater Ballads, and I even began to learn by heart the ones I liked most of all. We would tell tales at night, under the huge tropical moon, Hob and the Indian gentleman leaning on the rail at the stern of the ship.
You know, there's a lot we don't know about the sea. I've been in shipping on and off, donkey's years now. I don't know a blessed thing more than I did about what's under there. There's more sea than land, and there's a lot goes on land that's pretty bloody mysterious, eh?
Ah, you are talking about mermaids, then. The cold, fishy women with clammy kisses and scaly breasts. Ladies who lure you by clasping you to their cold bosoms and then make you go, "Now I am dead, oh dear, oh me," by dragging you beneath the briny?
No, I'm talking about what's under there.
Ah, young man, you are looking most remarkably well.
How did you know I was here?
Is he not looking well, Mr. Gadling?
If you say so.
Ah, but I do say so.
Hello, lad.
Mr. Gadling?
We are pondering the sea at this moment, and I was also telling Mr. Gadling about the fickleness of women.
And I was telling him that he was talking out of his kyber.
Ah, yes, the entertaining English slang. Let us go up the apples and the pears together. But I tell the truth. Listen, once there was a king who had a wife whom he loved more than life itself. More than life itself. This is no pretty turn of phrase. Listen. One day, there came a holy man to the palace. He was thin as a scarecrow, his beard white as pearl, his skin blackened and gnarled like burnt wood by the sun. He demanded to see the king. The guards refused him entry, whereupon he took a knife from his loincloth and with one hard swipe cut off his left hand at the wrist. They were most astonished at this action, more so when they realized that there was no blood issuing from the wound. The holy man picked up his hand, which was crawling around in the dust, scuttling and skittering like a scorpion, and fastened it once more to his wrist with a mystic gesture. Magically, he was whole again. "Now," he said, "take me to your king." And they did. The holy man was brought to stand before the king on his throne dressed in the finest silks. The holy man took a piece of fruit from his loincloth and held it out. "Light of the gods on earth," he began, "I am, as you can see, a holy man. And I have, through trials undreamed of, and through alchemy and through prayer, obtained for myself this fruit. In appearance, it partakes of both the fig and the apple. It is, however, the fruit of life, and whoever eats of it shall live forever. The king came down from his throne now. He and the holy man looked at the fruit held in the holy man's outstretched palm.
So why do you not eat of it?
Asked the king, who was nobody's fool but his own. For three reasons. Firstly, I am an old man. Immortality should be given to the young and those in good health. Secondly, I desire to remain upon the karmic wheel of death and rebirth on my path to eventual rewards far greater than living forever.
And thirdly?
Asked the king. Thirdly, I am too scared to taste of it.
How can you assure me?
Asked the king.
That this is not poisonous, that you are not tricking me.
So the old man ordered a mongoose brought to him and fed it with his hands a tiniest slice of the fruit. Then he ordered a fire kindled and the animal tossed into the furnace. In time, the fire burned down and the king saw the mongoose questing about inside, unharmed by the flames. Then the king knew that the man was telling him the truth, and he took the fruit with thanks. He ordered that gold be brought for the holy man, but the holy man refused it and went on his way. The king pondered the gift of immortality. Now, he had a wife whom he loved, as I said, more than life itself. For he decided that this wife should receive the gift of the fruit and not him. That night, he suited deed to word and gave his wife the fruit of life. Alas, his wife was as unfaithful as any woman, and she had a lover who was a captain of the palace guard. And that night, because she loved him, she gave her captain the fruit of life. There was a prostitute in the town, not a raggedy-assed prostitute, but a courtesan, like they had in those days, with whom the captain was infatuated, and whose favors he bought with gems and gold and silver that he cozened from the queen. And to her he brought the fruit untouched. She was very beautiful, but she was uncertain enough of the fruit and of its provenance, and desirous enough of earthly reward to hie herself to the palace. She offered the fruit to the king. He took it from her, and once she had told him how she had obtained it, ordered her to be rewarded. Then he had the queen and her lover brought to him and had them both killed without torture though, for he had loved her more than life itself. He dressed himself in the clothes of the poorest beggar in his realm, and making his brother king in his stead, he left the palace. He ate the fruit and walked out of the city into the ruck, never to be seen again.
There. So you see the point I make concerning women and the fickleness of what your Mr. Kipling has so justly castigated as a species more deadly than the males.
I think it's a stupid story.
He's got a point there, old friend. Women aren't unfaithful, it's people are unfaithful, and men tend to get a lot more opportunity than women to mess about.
What would ye, ladies? It was ever thus. Men are unwise and curiously planned. They have their dreams, and do not think on us, what take the golden road to Samarkand.
Sorry?
It's poetry. I read it in a book. Why does the water glow like that?
The dream magic of the sea.
No, phosphorescent algae.
Anyway, the story wasn't true.
No?
Nobody lives forever. Last ship I was on, my friend Harry fell from the rigging. We wrapped him in sail and threw him overboard. First he floated, then he tipped up and sank.
You are a deep one, young Jim.
What?
Like the sea. You've got hidden depths. Do you ever wonder about what goes on under there? There's more sea than there is land, after all, and We never see more than the tiniest fraction of it. Oh, there's a storm on the way.
How can you tell, Mr. Gatling?
Years of experience.
Get those sails in before we're on our beam ends.
There was a storm the next day, and half the chickens were washed overboard.
Macefield's a fine poet, Jim.
I like him. I enjoyed working for Mr. Gatling.
How's that?
He was a funny man. And he was clever, too. He'd been on the ship less time than I had, but he knew everything that happened on board. He'd tell me things about the crew. For example, he knew about Mr. Canby's gin business, which was more than the skipper did.
Porthole's done.
Very good. You can tidy my desk and then you're all done.
He knew about the history of shipping too. Old boats and ships. One evening, he told me about the slave ships. How all the slaves would be linked together by one long chain. So if they sighted a naval ship, they'd just throw the slave at the end of the chain overboard and the rest would follow into the sea.
What you got there, boy? Round your neck?
It's my lucky stone. I was given it in Singapore. It's meant to stop you being drowned.
A lump of chalcedony won't stop you drowning, but I'll tell you how not to drown if you like.
Really? Honest?
Sure. Don't drown.
Huh?
You just don't drown. I've done it half a dozen times. It's easy once you get the hang of it. Don't drown.
Very funny, Mr. Gatling.
It's not a joke, Jim. Although if you take it too seriously, you're in deep trouble. I'm going up on deck, I think. Bit of fresh air never hurt anybody.
Chalcedony? Core. Come on, Jim. Finish the job. Hello? What's this? Between Mr. Gadling's sea chest and the wall, I found an old tin photograph, like they used to have, of two stiff-looking people, a man and a woman. The man looked enough like Mr. Gatling to be his father. It had writing on it. To my Bobby, till death, my sweet, your own Elspeth. I put it down on the chest. Next day I cleaned his cabin, but the photograph was gone. After the storm, the winds abandoned us. We were becalmed, and the sails hung limp and lifeless from the masts. The first day of it, nobody said anything much. The crew did wind things, each in their own way. Some of them whistled idly, as if they were happy, as they went about their business. Whistled for the wind.
There, that'll do it.
Nat Dorning had a lump of pink coral wrapped in white sealskin, which he hung from the bowsprit. It did no good. The ship still hung, seemingly suspended, on a sea that was as flat and reflective as glass. Next morning, the skipper himself walked down to the stern of the ship and threw his oldest shoes into the water.
Of course it works. If you really need wind, the skipper has to throw his old shoes overboard.
Ah, a propitiatory sacrifice. How remarkably sagacious.
I thought it had worked at first, because the sea soon darkened in the east. But then we realized it was...
Fish! Look at them! It's fish!
He was right. The sea was alive with fish. Fish of all manner and shape and size. Dolphins leaped and splashed, throwing up showers of tiny fishes. The water churned and glittered silver. A sea full of fish, all of them swimming towards the west.
Quick! Get that net over the side and catch some provisions. Darnie, swing up some salt in empty barrels.
Aye, aye, Captain!
On the skipper's urging, we lowered a net and hauled aboard more fish than we could have eaten in a month of Sundays, from huge cod to tiny glittering jewelfish, whose names I never knew. There was even a shoal of flying fish, which I thought unknown in those parts, some of which landed on the deck of the Sea Witch.
They're just throwing themselves aboard now, lads!
Mr. Gatling picked one up as it writhed and flopped on the deck, and he threw it back into the thrashing water.
Have you ever seen anything like this?
And then the fish were past us, gone to the west. The waters emptied, went from silver to blue, and from blue to black. Up in the rigging, the lookout gave a hail. He'd seen something far away in the sea, something looking like an island, a black something in the water.
Lando!
Are you mad, man? There's no land here.
I can see it.
Where is it?
Over there. That's funny. It's gone.
And then the deck lurched and tipped and bucked, and the world went mad. The waves were suddenly mountainous. The ship heeled over, everyone grabbing for something to hold onto. A huge wave, dark green, rose high over the masts, but it did not break over us. It was no wave. The sea serpent was unimaginably huge, its coils, each bigger than a dreadnought, curling around us in the water. Its head was long, with a snout like a dragon. There was a long fin running down its spine, crested with bony knuckles. The sea serpent's body was encrusted with barnacled, seaweeded scales. Another loop of the beast was visible in the extreme distance. Something this big could never exist on land. It made the ship look like a tiny toy thing bobbing on a pond. And then, just as suddenly as it arrived, it was gone. The ocean was still again. But no one said anything. Had everyone been swept overboard? I looked around. The crew were safe and on deck. They wore expressions of shock and joy. Some were weeping. They seemed to be trying to gather their thoughts, as if everything they thought they knew was but a drop in any ocean which could contain a creature such as this. Mr. Gadling was nearest me, his head tipped a little on one side. He looked, in some way, almost amused.
Wind's picking up, lads. Let's have the reefs out of the mainsail.
Aye, aye, Captain.
Mr. Gadling, we saw it. The sea serpent. We saw it.
So?
So, we've got to tell everyone. I mean, it's real. It's not imaginary. We saw it.
Of course we did, Jim.
A hard wind came up then and filled the sails.
Everyone aloft, Mr. Canby, if you please. All sails set.
Aye, sir. Get aloft, lads. Let's move this town.
The captain and Mr. Canby began to shout at us. We made good time to aid him. Mr. Gadling, you saw the sea serpent, didn't you? We all did.
Of course I did, Jimmy. I've seen an awful lot of strange things in my time, and this is one of the best yet.
But no one's talking about it. When I ask the other sailors about it, they just change the subject.
You surprised by that?
Yes, I suppose I am. I mean, we could tell the world. They'd know there really was sea serpents.
Well, we'll dock in Aden by this afternoon. Soon as the shore leave, you could go into the city, find some newspaper correspondent and tell him what we saw.
Would he believe me?
You could bring him back to the ship. He could ask around. The truth would probably come out eventually.
Mr. Gadling, why hasn't anyone seen it before?
Maybe they have. There's tales of sea serpents after all, but the sea's a big place, Jim, and deep. For example, nobody's seen a giant squid that I know of. They just suppose there have to be some because they've seen the huge sucker marks on the sides of whales. Big place. There's lots of secrets down there.
We made Aden later that day. We were to take on provisions before sailing on for the Suez Canal. I was given shore leave the following afternoon, and I went into the city, along with some of my shipmates. The horizon was beginning to lighten when I returned to the ship. The Indian gentleman and Hob were sitting together on the quay, perched on crates of stores for the ship.
We can meet any time. You don't owe me anything. There's few enough of us around. Least we can do is watch out for each other.
Your sea witch. She is so beautiful aboard.
I'm out of shipping next time around. Printing again, I think. Or publishing, maybe. Hello, Jim.
Good evening, young James. Ah, me. It is past the hour when all well-meaning folks are safe in the arms of Mr. Morpheus. For myself, I am up the wooden hillock to Bedfordshire. I shall leave you two young people together.
So, you've been ashore then?
Yes.
Who'd you tell?
Tell?
About the sea serpent.
Nobody.
I didn't think you'd say anything. Like I said, we've all got secrets, and you don't want to draw attention to yourself. Isn't that right, girl?
How did you know?
You're not the first lass I've known in my time was passing, nor even the 50th. Oh. There are things you get to recognise given enough time. Some of it's the voice, and some of it's the hands, and a lot of it is learning to see what you see and not what you think you see, if that makes any sense.
It's not fair. Men can be sailors. Why can't girls?
Because life's not fair, I suppose. There, and that's profundity for you. What's your real name then, Jim?
Margaret. Mama used to call me Peggy.
She's a lovely ship, isn't she?
Is she really yours?
Smart girl. You was listening. Yeah, she's mine. Well, until we dock in Liverpool, she's mine. I think you've seen this.
Your photograph?
Yes, my photograph. And I will have the sad duty of telling the company that my great-uncle here, Robert Gadling, died of something properly tropical in Calcutta. He's left me his shares in the company as Uncle Bob.
Uncle Bob?
Well, sell him on. No interest in boats as young Robbie, back from 20 years abroad. There. Then there'll be nothing left could link me with the old man.
How old are you, sir?
Old enough to have learned to keep my mouth shut about seeing a bloody great snake in the middle of the ocean. Come on then, back aboard.
You won't tell anybody about me, will you, Mr. Gadling?
Call me Hob. Given time, you'll spin a yarn of what we saw in the ocean. Given time, I'll tell the tale of the handsome cabin boy. But given enough time and the right audience, the darkest of secrets scum over into mere curiosities. No one will believe either of us anyway.
I last saw Mr. Gadling on the dock in Liverpool. He left with the Indian gentleman, and I never saw neither of them again. I've not dared tell my tale before, and if I thought this inn was a real place, and all of you anything more than phantoms and opium ghosts, I'd not have told it now. And I shipped from Liverpool to Rio, and from Rio to the Azores, and from there to Boston, and now to Newfoundland. And, save for Mr. Gadling, there was never a man-jack thought me anything but a true-born boy. Though there were a few close shaves. Oh, but I'm getting too old for the trick, which troubles me. For the sea is in my blood like a fever, and I don't know how I can leave. Though I know my time on the sea, like the tall ships, draws to its end. So it makes no difference to me whether you believe a word of it or not. And when, someday soon, I forsake the sea, like a sailor leaving his lady love on the shore, I shall take another name to me and build myself another life. But for now, you can call me Jim.
In the inn at the World's End, which may or may not exist, don't ask me, there are more rooms than I've ever seen in a bar, anywhere. Not that I hang out in bars in the real world. Wherever that is.
It's not a bar. It's an inn.
Well, that's what the innkeeper told me as she showed me upstairs. I don't know how big this place is. If I didn't know any better, I think it had grown since I first carried Charlene through the door and met the weirdest bunch of freaks and misfits in my life. But they, like us, were sheltering from the storm. They took us in, fixed us up, and gave us food and drink. Maybe a little too much food and drink. I'd been listening to stories all night, which also seemed to have gone on much longer than it should have, while the storm howled and screamed and rumbled outside. And suddenly, I couldn't take it anymore. So she showed me to a room where she said I could rest. The room was small and old-fashioned. There was a water jug on the bedside table and a candle in a holder. I lay on the bed and listened to the boom and crash of the thunder and the howl of the wind. I must have slept, but I have no idea for how long. When I woke up, there was a cheese sandwich waiting for me on a tray by the door.
Room service.
Good.
The bread was new baked and the cup of coffee beside it was piping hot. Tasted great, too.
Oh, that hit the spot.
I decided to take it downstairs and eat it with the others. The corridor was lit by candles. But where I remembered the staircase had been was now a small alcove, like a library.
Holy shit.
A flicker of lightning, and for a moment, I thought I saw people talking, like tarot characters, moving down the corridor. But the darkness came again, and they were gone. I walked to the library alcove. It had a little oil lamp on a desk, with two armchairs.
Hello.
Whoa! I thought I was alone up here.
No, I also am here. I apologize for having startled you.
It's okay, it's only coffee. It'll come out. Got a tissue somewhere here, I think.
One of the armchairs contained a small Chinese man. His head was shaved, and he was wearing a green silk high-collared robe. He was small, ageless, and very polite.
I ought to get back downstairs, I suppose. I've a friend there. You get caught in the storm, too?
Storm? No. I saw no storm.
You didn't get caught in a storm. How'd you get here?
On my way to somewhere else. You were from where?
Seattle.
Seattle, Washington? In America? The United States of America?
Sure, of course. I mean, how many Americas are there?
Many. Many, many, many. But perhaps less than there used to be. I am honored to make your acquaintance.
Me too. Hi.
The America you come from. Who was the president when you left?
Oh, I didn't leave. Clinton. Bill Clinton.
And before him?
George Bush.
And before Bush, Reagan? And before him, who?
Jimmy Carter.
You come from one of those Americas. You have my sympathy.
Gee, thanks. So if you aren't hiding out from the storm, what are you doing?
I am a seeker. I am a follower. Let me tell you of the one I follow.
A beautiful, bouncing baby boy, Mrs. Rickard.
He sure is, Doctor.
Have you folks decided on a name yet?
Oh, yes.
His mother understood that names have power. Names do not define us, but they influence us for good or ill, help to shape and form us. Perhaps she saw a little of the future that day. Perhaps she was merely inspired by a higher power, and she named her newborn...
Prez. Oh, It's short for president.
The Sandman, Act 3, Episode 17. World's End, Golden Boy.
The golden-haired boy bore his name with pride. Each morning, he would recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Other children would rise and speak, but he knew that for them the pledge was merely words and sounds like the alphabet. For the child Prez Ricard, each morning was a moment of dedication, of magic. With all his heart and mind and soul, he would pledge himself to something larger than himself. When Prez was six, President Kennedy told the American people not to ask what their country could do for them, but instead to ask what they could do for their country. Prez Ricard knew that already.
The gear train transmits power from the mainspring to the escapement.
My people have, of old, divided the world into two kinds of people, hedgehogs and foxes. Hedgehogs know one big thing. Foxes know lots of little things. Prez Ricard knew two big things. One of them was America. The other was time. The town of Steadfast was famed for its clocks. Every house, every store, every steeple and public building boasted its own clock that chimed or boomed or sang the hours and half hours. Sadly, no two clocks in Steadfast agreed. When Prez was 13, his mother lost sight of him in the town center of Steadfast.
Stipulated clearer delineation.
She found him some hours later in the town hall. When he was 16, Prez fixed and adjusted single-handed every clock in Steadfast.
I think that's got the town hall clock back on time.
That was the same year that Congress gave 18-year-olds the vote. Inevitably, the mass of 18-year-olds voted to lower the age limit on elected officials and voted themselves into the Senate, into Congress, and then, the following year, and to no one's surprise, they lowered the age limit on the presidency to 18. The prince of the political world was Boss Smiley.
He's rumored to be the kingmaker, the fixer, the power